Welcome to the first of our new series on the history of the Bible. And for those of you who want to do some homework, you can see you will get this as a handout later. I'm still having trouble with my computer, so I couldn't quite get everything ready this morning the way I wanted to, but you'll get a copy of this later. I would encourage you, if you are interested in this subject, to look at the four things that you have up there. You can trust the Bible. That's Dr. Maxwell's small book. It's a very good, very brief summary. There's some excellent articles at the beginning of Volume 1 of the SDA Bible Commentary. Some of you might be into the modern media. You might be interested in this thing. This is the hard copy. It's available actually in DVD and in audio cassette format. It's called The Story of the Bible. This is by Dr. Luke Timothy Johnson, who's a very interesting character. He used to be a Benedictine monk, and he's now an emeritus professor at Emory University, married, and obviously he's not a Benedictine monk anymore. Has degrees from various kinds of major institutions, and has some very interesting things to say about the history of the Bible. With his background, you would guess that he looks at the Bible a little different than some of the rest of us do on occasion. So you got to be aware of that. Two other books. Many of you probably have this in your library somewhere if you've attended Adventist institutions for many years, called The Ancestry of Our English Bible. The third edition, as far as I know, is the latest one, was done in 1956, so it's not like the latest thing off the press. It was done by Ira Price, but it's still a very interesting volume. And, of course, yeah, this one is called The Ancestry of Our English Bible. It's up there. See? And then, of course, almost everyone's Bible, no matter what it is, especially if you get a study Bible, and this is mine, which is just about worn out, but I keep repairing it and so forth. It'll have something in the introduction. The King James, the original 20-pound King James Version, had an excellent introduction, which if someone wants it, I could give you an electronic copy or whatever, entitled The Translators to the Readers. Very interesting article there, which is no longer printed in the King James, unfortunately, but it said things like this: hath the kingdom of God become words and syllables? Let us not be slaves to them, let us be free. So it's interesting to think about. But having said that, we now come into our major issue, and that's, we're going to talk about the history of the Bible. And I would like you to, as we start, to ask yourself some questions. When you pick up your Bible to read it, and yours probably looks better than this, I mean, is it all right? You know, I know the story of an older couple who was a pastor, the husband was a retired pastor, and he got into some of these new Bibles, and he was carrying one around that was kind of a light blue color, a little bit like mine, and his wife just said to him, "Why can't you carry a black leather Bible to church? That thing is no Bible. How can a light blue thing be a Bible, you know?" So people just have different ideas about what the Bible is supposed to be. And there are lots of different reasons for that, as we will see. But when you pick up your Bible, you need to ask yourself these questions. Do we have the correct words? Do we have the correct books? Are the modern translations accurate? Are there some translations which are not reliable? Can we understand the meaning? And of course, that's the ultimate real issue. Can we understand the meaning? And that's really based on, can we understand the context? And now, a big, huge question: when and where does the study of the Bible begin? And bear with me, because I think we need a little history here. You may be aware, if you aren't, I'll try to get you up to snuff here in just a second or two, that the Egyptologists and those who study the Mesopotamian Valley, following back Sumerian history and so forth, will basically tell you that they can trace human history back 30,000 1,000 years. Now, some of us have questions about that. Now, you know, just to get the context here, and I hope I'm not trying to shake anybody's faith, but let's look at the issues here and so we can know what some of our friends are concerned about. According to Usher's chronology, and now remember, Usher was a Catholic bishop. He was assigned the job of making a calendar of all the holy days for a whole year. That was his job. And in the process of trying to do that, he tried to establish, a lot of it was just pure guesswork, but he tried to establish when things had happened in the past history. So when, in other words, if you celebrate Easter, well, what time in the year did Easter happen? If you celebrate Christmas, what time in the year did Christmas happen? And on and on and on like this. Usher lived around about, 400 AD, somewhere in there. And, so he put together this chronology, this calendar of holy days. Usher's chronology, which many Christians follow, the King James Bible has, if you buy a traditional King James Bible, it'll have the dates right up there in the top of the center column of the Bible, where the little notes are. So if it'll have many of the dates, it'll be right up there. According to Usher's chronology, the creation occurred 4,000 years B.C. 4,004, I think he said exactly. But, so that would mean that, basically our earth is now 6,000 years old. Now, I just said a moment ago that the people who study Sumerian history and the people who study Egyptian history believe that they can trace that history back maybe up to 30,000 years. That's a conflict. That's a disagreement. We have to deal with that. This class is probably not the place to deal with that, but at least we start off right at the beginning when we talk about ancient history with these kind of conflicts to deal with. Now, for many years, many, many, many years, human memory was so good that there really was no need to rewrite anything down or record it. They just remembered everything. You didn't need to write down a message to give to so-and-so-and-so because you just tell them once and they remembered it. And I will just tell you right now, we'll talk more about this later, I will tell you right now that there are many scholars who believe that the books of Moses were never written down by Moses. That he just gave those books to people he recited them to the people who were his followers, people like Joshua and so forth, and they recited to their friends, and they memorized these things. And they were passed down like that for a long periods of time before they were finally written down by somebody else. Now, maybe they were written down from memory, but that would mean that Moses didn't actually write them himself. Somebody else wrote them down a long time later. Don't shoot me yet. I'm just telling you these are the things that some people believe. There is pretty good evidence that writing was first invented around 3000 or 3500 BC. Now notice, try to keep these things straight because there'll be some discussion about this. I said writing. What were the original forms of writing?
Hieroglyphics and cuneiform.
Okay. Someone said pictures. Joanne said pictures. That's correct. They really were pictures. There were two original earliest forms of writing that we know about. And there were variations of each of these two forms. But basically, there was Egyptian hieroglyphics. The hieroglyphic system, and I don't claim to be an expert on hieroglyphics, but the hieroglyphic system basically uses pictures to tell stories. It's a pictographic language. Now, hold on. Yeah, just a second. There's a mic coming.
Well, what came first? To me, the Chinese writing is the oldest, and the Egyptian writing is later, after.
No, actually, Egyptian and Mesopotamian were first.
Were first.
Chinese.
Because they use sticks and like mm-hmm. now we do, you know, to make a B, you make a stick. To make mm-hmm. a P, you make a stick. You know.
Yeah.
All that.
Yeah, we'll talk about that.
Okay.
That's where we're going. Thank you. So basically the Egyptian hieroglyphic language, the pictures represented things. But then as time went on, they began to use pictures and let's just use an English example. Suppose here's a picture and that picture has come to mean mother. Well, they finally got to the place where they started using the mother symbol when they wanted to use the M sound. So see, they were sort of moving toward an alphabet. But basically, there's hieroglyphics thousands and thousands of thousands. You travel to Egypt, you'll find them hieroglyphics all over buildings and all over all kinds of stuff. It's all over the place in Egypt. Okay? The other type of earliest writing that was developed over in the Mesopotamian Valley is called cuneiform. By the way, the hieroglyphics mostly was carved into rock. A lot of it was, anyway. And that's why it's still there. But the cuneiform, which is over in the Mesopotamian Valley, was done on small clay tablets that were soft mud. And they would take a certain kind of a reed and they would cut it at an angle and they would form a little triangular stick and they would use this stick to make some lines this way and some lines this way. So there were lines like this across the page. And that was called cuneiform, which means triangle-like, something like that is what the name meant. And they would make these, they would put the stick in the mud and then they would slide it down or whatever like this. And that's the way they wrote. And the cuneiform language was a syllabary language, by and large. That means they had, I don't know how many different numbers of symbols, quite a lot of them, several hundred of them, and they tended to represent a syllable. Each form represented a syllable. So it was a little bit complicated, or a pretty complicated language there. And today there are only a few people in our world who can read that language, which, by the way, if you've had a chance to look at the latest review, hopefully you all get it to your home, open it up and look inside there. There's a picture of a little cuneiform tablet that was just recently read, apparently for the first time, at the British Museum. They have thousands of these little things in the British Museum that nobody's ever read. Somebody who able to read the cuneiform was reading this little tablet and discovered that one of the minor characters in the Bible that's mentioned by name in the book of Jeremiah is mentioned on this little cuneiform tablet. So we now have one more evidence that the Bible is reliable. And there it is in history. Here it is in the Bible. Here it is on the cuneiform tablet. So if you get a chance to look at that article, because it'll give you a beautiful little picture of the cuneiform tablet in the latest review, just to look and see what little bit. And I hope I'm going to get this all put together so I can actually show you pictures of these things as we go along. But neither one of those languages, either the cuneiform or the hieroglyphics, are very precise. You know, you can get the general idea of what the person is talking about, but there's lots of different ways, as I hope you've already got the feel, that different ways to sort of read these different symbols and come up with, I mean, they're, you know, the general idea is there, but there's no real precision in these written languages. So around about 1500 BC, let me not say AD, 1500 BC, and again, I should say one more thing as we're talking about this. If you're talking with your Jewish friend, you shouldn't say BC and AD. They don't like that. So if you're talking with Jews, they will say CE, which is the expression for the common era, which is the equivalent to our AD, or they'll say BCE, which means before the common era. We say BC means before Christ. They say BCE means before the common era. So if you see CE and BCE, it's equivalent to AD and BC using the Christian's notation. And you will read that if you read the archaeology journals and so forth. You will see that pretty widespread, they use CE and BCE, and that may not be our first choice, but we shouldn't let that upset us. We just understand where our friends are coming from. So around 1500 BC, maybe a little before that, we don't know for sure, apparently the very first alphabets were invented. Now, you've probably seen pictures of this at some point in Encyclopedia Britannica or someplace like this. You know, there was this picture of a cow that's basically like this with a thing like this. It looks like a cow with his ears out to the side and his horns up like this. And then they end up turning it upside down and it ends up being an A, you know, because that the name for a cow starts with an A in their language. This kind of stuff. And so that's what happened. And the alphabet was probably invented either in Middle Egypt, central part of Egypt, or possibly in the Sinai Peninsula. Some of the oldest records we have available are actually in the Sinai Peninsula. And those very ancient alphabets, and someone got the idea that, you know, you could put a certain symbol for each sound that we can make with our mouths and therefore be able to make words using those symbols. And so the Moses came along. When did Moses live? All you historians? Remember? BC, yeah, that's a pretty good, BC is a pretty good guess. Moses lived around the Exodus. According to conservative Christians, and we'll talk a little bit about this probably somewhere down the line, according to conservative Christian estimates, the Exodus happened in 1445 B.C., or B.C.E. if you want to use the other notation. So Moses was how old at that time? 80 years old. This would mean he was born in 1525 B.C., okay? So Moses was born just about the time the alphabet was invented. So that is evidence that he could have written his books down himself. Whether he did or whether he didn't is still probably up for grabs, but he could have. The alphabet was available and it was written. Okay, what language was the alphabet in? There's a whole group of languages in that part of the world, not Egyptian, but rather what's sometimes called Syro-Palestinian languages that had this alphabet. And it can be used to write Moabite, it can be used to write Hebrew, it can be used to write Syrian and so forth like that. Different and Aramaic later use the same kind of letters. But let me be very clear on this issue, because we're talking a little bit out. I'm not going to dwell forever on the alphabet issue. This is not the alphabet that we have any of our Bibles written in. Let me say that once more. This original ancient Hebrew alphabet is not the alphabet that we have any of our Bibles written in. Now let me explain why that is. That ancient Hebrew alphabet, we only have a few examples of it. There's some from the ancient city of Byblos. They found a number of things found there. There's some found when they dug up the city of Samaria. The largest single example of that ancient writing is found on the Misha Stone. How many of you have heard about the Misha Stone? Okay. You know that it's a black stele that stands up like this, and it's in the British Museum, I believe, if I'm not mistaken. No, this is not, we haven't got to Rosetta. Hold on, don't go there yet. Don't go there yet. This is the Misha Stone, and this is on this stone is, on one side is a picture of King Misha, who was a king of the Moabites. And the story on the stone is how he rose up against King Omri's house and King Ahab of Israel and defeated the God of Israel and so forth and so forth. And it's very famous because it specifically mentions right on the stone there the God of Israel. And it's written in this ancient script. It's the largest single example we have of that ancient script. And it's unusual. It doesn't look like anything we've done this before, but let me just take a second and I'll show you what. Let's see, I can't do that. Come on. See if I can show you what. Okay. Now that's what Hebrew looks like today. If you go to Jerusalem. If you go to Jerusalem and you buy a newspaper, a local newspaper, it will be written just in the same kind of letters, but all the little dots will be missing. The little dots represent the vowels. Someone guessed which vowels are supposed to go in here, and they put these dots in a long time later. The ancient text did not have the little dots. Okay, now, I'm trying to do this logically so we won't get buried here. So while you're looking at that, let me explain where this is called the square text, and I guess you can guess why it's called the square text. Each little letter is very square. And this square text came from somewhere down in southern Mesopotamia about the time of King Nebuchadnezzar II, the King Nebuchadnezzar that's famous in the Bible. He introduced it to Babylon, and when the children of Israel were taken into Babylonian captivity, they learned to read and write Aramaic using this text, this kind of alphabet. Okay? So when they went back to Israel and they started rewriting their Bibles for copies for people, instead of using the old alphabet, they used this new alphabet. Are we all together here? You understand, men? This is around, well, the Babylonian captivity was 586. Well, the first time Nebuchadnezzar conquered Jerusalem was 605. So there was a 605 invasion, there was a 598 invasion, there was a 586 invasion. There were three different invasions, and collectively in 586 is when Jerusalem was fully and completely destroyed. And they did not return to Jerusalem until around 536, 535 BC and reestablished things and so forth there. And the one who was responsible for rewriting and collecting the Bibles and everything back in Jerusalem after the captivity was Ezra. And Ezra, of course, came along around 457 BC. It was almost 100 years later. He is the one who brought back the Bibles and started making copies and all this kind of stuff. But we're getting a little ahead of our story. Okay? So let's go back over here. Okay, that's a little bit about the alphabet. So the ancient alphabet was there in the days of Moses. We don't know for sure because we do not have, and let me just make this statement. I'll make it multiple times as we go along, but let me just make this very clear because some people don't realize this. We do not have a single original copy of any book of the Bible. We don't have any of the ones that were written by Moses or Jeremiah or Daniel or even the New Testament writers, Paul. Those original ones that they wrote, either they're still buried somewhere or they disappeared. All we have is copies of copies of copies of copies. Is that all? I want to make that point really clear. So we don't have any of the originals. So, Now, I'm about to move on. Well, let me just say a couple more things. So the Bible, as we have it today, is written in this kind of text, in Hebrew, and parts of the book of Esther and part of the book of Daniel are written in the same text, but it's Aramaic. And then the New Testament is written in what is called Koine Greek. And let me talk a little bit about Koine Greek. Hold on here just a minute. I'll show you what that looks like. Okay, let's see here. Where am I here? Where's my little expander here? Okay. Now the Hebrew, I was just heard some people whispering there. The Hebrews wrote from right to left, the backwards of what we write. The Greeks wrote from left to right as we do. So this is what the Greek looks like, okay? The book of the Genesis of Jesus Christ, son of David, son of Abraham, and so forth. You can read it right up there, right? It's all Greek to you? Okay, well this is the Koine Greek. Now let's talk about the Koine Greek a little bit. So, but actually, let me finish one more thing about the Hebrew before I go away. Just to review, when the Jews moved when they went into captivity from Palestine to Babylonian captivity, they were forced, like all the other captives who were taken to Babylon, to speak Aramaic. That was the official language that everybody was supposed to speak. It's very close to Hebrew, written with the same alphabet, but not the same language. So when they went back to Palestine after the Babylonian captivity, from that time forward, unless they were reading the Bible or unless they were priests officiating in the temple or something like that, the common language of the ordinary people was Aramaic. Now that's confusing because sometimes in the Bible it says, you know, they spoke in Hebrew. Now there's arguments about that, but it's generally agreed that when it talks in the New Testament about, because Peter talks about in the Hebrew tongue or something like that, and then he uses Aramaic words. So there's pretty good evidence that the common language of the ordinary people in New Testament times in Palestine was Aramaic. However, the official language at that point in time was Greek, because you remember Alexander, when he swept across the world, his idea was he was going to turn the whole world into Greeks. And every major city he took over, he tried to establish a city according to Greek pattern. He tried to install a gymnasium. He tried to install a group of Greek soldiers to sort of look after the place. And he wanted everyone to practice speaking Greek and to become Greek citizens. That was his goal. Well, he was pretty successful at that. Really he was. And when we come to New Testament times, the Jews were still having a huge battle over that. The big battle between the Sadducees and the Pharisees was the Sadducees thought, okay, let's get with it. Let's become Greek speaking. Let's act like the rest of the world. Let's integrate into society. So the Sadducees wanted everyone to become Greek behaving, if you will, following in the technical term for that is Hellenization. They wanted everybody to become act like Greeks. The Pharisees did not want that at all. They wanted to go back. They said the only pure language, the only pure culture is our Hebrew culture. We're going to stay with that. And so the huge background behind the conflict between the Sadducees and the Pharisees was The Sadducee says, let's move on. Let's join the modern world. Let's become like everybody else. The Pharisee says, nothing doing. Our heritage says this. Let's move back. Let's be like our ancestors. So that was the huge battle that was going on behind the scenes all the time between these two groups. Joanne, we got a mic somewhere handy back there.
Then when Jesus spoke to the Sadducees and the Pharisees, what language did he use?
Well, almost certainly he used Aramaic. However, it's very clear that he understood Greek. I'm sure he had to. I mean, he grew up, you know, the reason Joseph went to Nazareth is because the Romans are building a huge fortified city just a couple miles from Nazareth. I'm sure that's, he got a lot of his work from there. There's no question in my mind at all that Jesus understood Greek and could speak it quite fluently. So I'm sure that Jesus spoke at least three languages, the Hebrew, which the Bible was written in, the Aramaic, which was the common tongue of his people, and the Greek, which was the business language for everybody at that point in Palestine. Yeah, hold on, get a mic down here.
I saw a documentary about where the Dead Sea Scrolls were and the group of people that were there.
The Essenes.
They pointed out that they ate at tables, mm-hmm. whereas during Jesus' time, you know, they all laid out on the sides, just like the Greeks. And this was a contentious problem they seemed to have. They didn't want to be like the Greeks.
Yeah, the Essenes were really, I mean, they were more extreme than even the Pharisees. They wanted to go back. They wanted everybody to be like Moses and his, you know, descendants and so forth, or his times. They didn't want to have anything to do with the modern world. Yeah, they were very far in the other direction. Okay? Okay, so the Bible then was written in, you've seen some good examples there of, here's Greek. I showed you the Hebrew a little bit ago. And Aramaic, which looks the same as the Hebrew, but is actually a different language. Just like we use the same letters to write English, Spanish, Portuguese, but they are different languages. Same idea. So that was what the Bible is written primarily in Hebrew and Greek, but some Aramaic in a few places. And we've talked about the Egyptian hieroglyphics and the Mesopotamian cuneiform, about when the alphabet was invented, and whether Moses' original books were in oral form. That's a possibility. Now, coming down to a period of time, as you could guess, and we're just doing an overview here, it wasn't too long before people wanted the Bible. Well, let me just give you an example of this right out of the Bible itself. Look at Nehemiah chapter 8. Let's go over here. And I'm going to need to go to a different version here. There's my good news. Okay, Nehemiah 8. Okay, look at verse 4. Let's see. Ezra was standing on a wooden platform. Now this is Ezra comes back. Ezra and Nehemiah are back in Palestine now. We're talking about 440 years, something like that, BC now. And the people have rebelled against God's instructions. They've gone back to all the same kinds of sins that their ancestors were doing. They were doing all these awful things. And Ezra tried to reform them. He wasn't very successful. Nehemiah showed up and he was a little more successful. And we're not going to talk about how all happened. But they called all the people together and they said, we need to come back to the Lord. So we look at Nehemiah 8, starting with verse 4, Ezra was standing on a wooden platform that had been built from there for the occasion. The following men stood at his right and gives all their names. As Ezra stood there on the platform high above the people, they all kept their eyes fixed on him. As soon as he opened the book, they all stood up. Ezra said, praise the Lord, the great God. So here we have evidence that books were written and that Ezra was writing and so forth right here in the Bible. All the people raised their arms in the air and answered, amen, amen. They knelt to worship with their faces to the ground. Then they rose and stood in their places, and the following Levites explained the law to them. The law meant what? What does law mean when written in the Old Testament? The books of Moses, the Torah. We're going to talk about the Tanakh in a few minutes. But the law, when written with a capital letter like this, refers to the five books of Moses. So, and there's the people's names again. And notice verse 8. They gave an oral translation of God's law and explained it so that the people could understand it. That's the first modern speech translation right there in the Bible. Okay? They were,
I'm sorry. I where?
In verse 8? Nehemiah 8, verse 8. They gave an oral translation of God's law and explained it so that the people could understand it. So what's happened here? Let's get the picture. Hundreds and thousands of people are gathered around. They made a platform so that the people could be seen and heard. Ezra is standing up there. He's reading a scroll now. And we haven't talked about writing material. I need to talk about that next. He's reading a scroll. So he's got to roll up one side and unroll the other side. He reads a column down like this. And these eight people that he has standing around him, they're probably scattered out some distance to both sides. These are people who know both Hebrew and Aramaic. So they're standing out there. They hear Ezra speak the Hebrew. And then they explain it. They translate it and explain it in Aramaic. Now, Aramaic is pretty close to Hebrew, but it's not the same. Okay, it's like translating maybe from Spanish to Portuguese. Go ahead. Oh, I'm sorry. Need a mic.
What books did Josiah find? Was that the books of Moses?
Yes.
And that was long before this, right?
Yes, that was just before the Babylonian captivity. So that would be 250 years before this. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So let me now talk about a couple of the other issues. Well, let me talk about writing material first. What did they write on? We're not going to spend a lot. I mean, this is the only time we're going to spend a lot of time on this kind of stuff, but it's important to understanding. What did they write on? They went down and bought a big case of Xerox paper and, right?
Sheepskins.
Okay, sheepskins were used in times a little before Jesus and thereafter. Prior to that, they didn't have them. Well, they may have used them some, but we don't have much evidence for that because they deteriorate. So we don't know for sure how far back they used sheepskins, but yes, they did use some skins. What did they use before they used sheep? I already talked about the Egyptians carved in stone. I talked about the Mesopotamians used little clay tablets in the wet mud. What else did they use? They used what? Papyrus, okay. Papyrus came along later. They were using it fairly early. And basically papyrus, you can still get papyrus. I mean, it's a curiosity now, but from Egyptian. And basically, there are reeds. They grow in the water around Egypt. They're big, thick things, and you can slice them very thin, and you can lay them down side by side, and then you lay another layer 90 degrees to that, and if you press them together and let them dry, you get something that's sort of like paper. And they did that, and they learned how to do that ways back. We don't know exactly how far back that went. But even then, this ancient stuff, we basically don't have any documents, none, zero, in terms of scrolls or papyrus, that kind of stuff, that goes back before about 200 B.C., except for the stone stuff and the cuneiform stuff. Okay? So what did they write on other than stones and cuneiform tablets back then? Papyrus, what did they use before that?
Wax?
No. think so. I'm not aware of any wax. Yes. They use wax to seal their documents.
They use the dry leaves or something like a paper.
Well, that was the papyrus we're talking about.
Yeah.
No, interestingly enough, what they were using.
They use bricks.
Okay, well, that was the mud stuff I was talking about. If you look at the bricks that Nebuchadnezzar used in building his city, there's a lot of them. You can go to find them in Babylon, in the British Museum, and you can find them in the Louvre in Paris, and you can find them in the museum in Germany, etc. And every one of those bricks has his name written on it. Yeah. But the interesting thing is, what did the kids use when they were learning to write and all that kind of stuff? No, not really slates. No, this was before scrolls. And I thought this was going to be an easy question. No, dust, they probably did use some of that. No, actually what they wrote on was broken pieces of pots. Ostraca. Some of the earliest ink was just charcoal ground up very fine and mixed with water, and they used various kinds of devices to smear that on pots. And these things are called ostraca, is the technical name or whatever like this. But the oldest documents that we find from anywhere except for the stones and the cuneiform are these broken pieces of pots. And so when the archaeologists are digging in the ground looking for something, they find a little piece of pot. The first thing you want to know, is there anything written on it? A broken piece of pot. Is there anything written on it? So that was the early writing period. You could guess that they made pots out of clay, and very often they got broken. Well, you can't put a broken pot back together. They didn't have super glue or anything like that. So a broken pot becomes something to write on. That's what they did. They what?
They just take it home after they write on it.
Well, do whatever they probably wrote on it at home as well. Now, let's talk about the different Bibles. Now we're talking about collecting. Ezra was probably the first one to put together an actual collection of books and call it a Bible. I didn't call it Bible. Bible is a Greek name, but what we would sort of call a Bible. He was the first one to put the collection together. So prior to that, what did they have? How much of the Old Testament, as we call it, the Old Testament, the Hebrews would call the Old Testament the Tanakh, and you need to be familiar with that name. Tanakh is you see it there spelled on the screen. Right here. See the word there, Tanakh? Tanakh is a Hebrew word for the Old Testament. That is their Bible. Of course, they don't recognize the New Testament. The Tanakh means the Torah. It's actually an acronym. The A's are not in the Hebrew. So it's actually TNK. That's what they call it, TNK. And the T stands for Torah. And the N stands for Navi. Which is the prophets, and Kevim is the writings, the holy writings, and that's another thing I need to say. I keep thinking of things I need to talk about. Hebrew words, every Hebrew word has a root that's only three letters long. The root itself is only three letters long. So you have TNK, that's the word for their Bible, and it's an acronym, the Torah, the Nevi'im, and the Ketuvim. So that's what the Hebrew name for their Bible, what we would call the Old Testament. So now, I said that the first sort of Tanakh, or the first Old Testament, was put together in the days of Ezra. What did they have before that? We need to think about these issues because it has implications. What did they have before that? Scrolls. A lot of separate individual scrolls. And there were a lot of people, maybe I shouldn't say a lot, there were some people who wrote other books claiming that they were inspired. And here you have a scroll that says this one's, you know, they're claiming to be inspired, and here's all these other ones. You say, yeah, those are inspired. And so how do you decide? That was one of the big challenges. You know, which books should be in our Bible and which books shouldn't be in our Bible. So that's the next big question. How do we decide which books should be included and which books shouldn't be included? Joanna?
Was that one of the things that Ezra needed to debate or to think about, or did he have no question at that time?
Well, that's a real hard question to answer because I have no way of interviewing Ezra. What Ezra did was this, and we should be really thankful. I mean, basically, we owe our Old Testament to Ezra. What he did is he went around among the people when they got back from Babylonian captivity. He said, do you have any written materials? Do you have any written materials? Do you have any written materials? And he gathered these all together, and he started what we call the scribes. And he got all these things together. They decided on some kind of a standardized way of doing this, and they started making copies. But they copied from the old alphabet to the new alphabet that I showed you, the new Hebrew alphabet, the square alphabet. And so they were the ones who introduced that new square alphabet, but that didn't happen until around 450 BC. Yeah.
So some of the scrolls survived the captivity?
Yes, definitely. Yeah. And again, or maybe, I don't know even for sure exactly what form they were all in, but yes. And some of those books may have been memorized, and that was the only form they survived in. So some of the old people said, yeah, I know about the book of Micah. Let me recite it to you. And then Ezra wrote it down. Yes.
Did everything that a particular prophet write, say Nehemiah, was that everything that he wrote included in the Bible? Were there certain things were selected and certain things that were left out? And what did they use for a guide?
What proof do I have of that? Do you remember? There's a good text for that. See if I can go to it right way. Let's see.
Well, there's one text that says, and the other writings, something like that.
Yeah, but there's one that's even better than that. Okay. If you go to the writings of Solomon, how many Proverbs do we have? And how many songs? Well, if you look at the book of Psalms, you take the Song of Solomon, which is a single song, and you go, and if you look in the book of Psalms, there may be two or three. There's, I think, one that's specifically attributed to Solomon. There may be a couple of others that might be from Solomon. So we, of Solomon's songs, we have about three or four. Of his Proverbs, we have about 200 or 300. If you go through all through Proverbs, and then you include all the Proverbs that are in Ecclesiastes, we have about 300 or 400. Well, look at this. Verse 1 Kings 4:32, he composed 3,000 Proverbs and more than 1,000 songs. So where are all the rest of them? We have four songs, and we have about 250 Proverbs. Where are the rest of them? So here's actual numbers that just tell us, no, we don't. There were a lot of the things that some of these people wrote that we don't have. Now, some people tried to correct that problem by collecting what they believed were other writings from Solomon. And so if you look in the Apocrypha, you'll find books called The Wisdom of Solomon and so forth and so forth. Whether those are really from Solomon or not, we don't know. Gordon, here, grab this one.
There's also places, I think it's in Chronicles, where it says, and other events are recorded in the book of whatever, which we don't have.
There are in the Bible at least 24 other books referred to by different names that we no longer have, unless they're different names for some of the things that we have. So it's possible that some of the books we have might have had different names at some time in the past, and so when they mention that name, it's some book that we have. Let me give you an example of that. Um, see if I can, no, hold on here. You know what? I need to come down here. I don't want to spend too much time looking for this. But if you remember, in the Old Testament, if you go down through, it'll say things like, all the other events of King so-and-so's life are recorded in such and such a book. And in some cases it says, in the writings of Asher, or the writers of this or that or the other. And so there are, and way back in the books of Moses, it talks about book Jashub or something like that, the writings of Jashub or something, or the poems of Jashub there. So there are other books which we know that the Bible refers to. We know the names of, but we don't have any copies of.
Well, you know, in Deuteronomy 31, it says that God, that Moses wrote down all the law, and he said to, and he delivered it to the priests and said that it should be read.
Yeah.
So was that a scroll?
Okay.
Or?
Now, I mentioned to you a little while ago that there are a lot of scholars who believe that Moses did not write his books, but rather that they were only recorded in oral form. I personally believe, based on the writings of Ellen White, that he did write his books down, that he first wrote Genesis and Job while he was herding sheep out in the desert, and he later wrote the books of Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, as they happened, as it was going on. But that is a very conservative view and not shared by many modern scholars. And we'll talk about some of the reasons why they... Yeah. Yeah. It says that there. And I agree with that. But I said a lot of scholars don't. Yes, Bob.
Are we to assume that the Bible does not include all of the inspired writings of the prophets of those days?
That is a good question. It seems very clear that 1 and 2 Kings and 1 and 2 Chronicles, for example, were put together by people later, collecting things from various sources and making a book out of it. So, if, let's say, Ezra, for example, there's pretty good evidence that Ezra is probably one who wrote 1st and 2nd Chronicles. Okay? And he looked at the ancient records. He looked at all those records he had together, and he put together the story from a certain perspective, and he wrote it down. Okay, do you believe that the first person who wrote the original stories was inspired? Do you believe that Ezra was inspired by copying them? Do you believe that Ezra, that the first person was not inspired, but Ezra was inspired when he picked and chose from all those things, writing only the things which were true, and therefore, even though he was copying from uninspired sources, now when he puts his story together, it's inspired? Those are the challenges.
Well, Mrs. White quotes other authors, mm-hmm. and we assume that that's inspired because now she recognizes it. But my question is, all of the writings that the prophets wrote during the days that they were alive, even if those scrolls still existed, some of that is not included in the Bible. Mm-hmm. Does that mean that that portion was not inspired? I mean, the Bible refers to the Book of Enoch. We have the Book of Enoch, and we have the passages that the Bible refers to.
But some of them.
Some of them, yeah. But those are not included.
That's correct, because other things that are in the Book of Enoch are complete nonsense.
Right. So, I mean, were these people that decided, Ezra, was he inspired to pick the books that God...
That's the big kind of question. It's one of the huge questions we must, we have to decide. And that's one of the reasons why we're doing this class. Is it not just the person who wrote the original stuff down, but the people who copied it, the people who decided to include it in the collection? How much inspiration is going on here? And at what level? Yeah, those are the questions. And I could give you my opinion right now, but I think it's better if we sort of work our way through it a little bit, and then hopefully you'll be able to make an educated guess about it yourself before we get done. Okay? I have not said I need to say one more thing, at least one more thing about the Old Testament, and then I'll say a few words about the New Testament. It's a completely different story, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it right now. One of the challenges with reading the Old Testament, if you're a scholar and you know the ancient languages, is that the vocabulary of the Old Testament was very limited. Some people have suggested that there was no more than 800 different roots in Hebrew. I'm not a Hebrew scholar myself. Let me see if I can read you something about that. See it here. Oh, here we go. Yeah. This maybe will explain it better than I can. Once again, we need to zoom this out so you can read it. The greater part of the Old Testament, this is from Volume 1 of the SDA Bible Commentary. The greater part of the Old Testament was written in Hebrew, usually called Ancient Hebrew. Now, hopefully you understand why that is. Remember, that's the old alphabet. In order to distinguish it from Mishnaic and modern Hebrew, that's the square letters we're talking about. And in the Mishnaic Hebrew includes not only the square letters, but it includes all those little dots. Okay, that's the Mishnaic Hebrew. Mishnaic Hebrew is the Hebrew of the Christian era, an artificially revived language in which the Jewish rabbis wrote their scholarly works and which is now employed as the official language of the State of Israel. The term Hebrew language, found for the first time in the prologue to the apocryphal book Ecclesiasticus, which was written about 132 BC, is also used by the Jewish historian Josephus in the first century of the Christian era and appears later in the rabbinic writings. The term Hebrew tongue, used by Luke in Acts 21:40 and 26:14, refers to Aramaic and not to the Hebrew. Aramaic was a common language spoken in New Testament times. We've gone through all that pretty much. The biblical term used for the language spoken by the Old Testament Israelites is the language of Canaan, Isaiah 19:18, or the Jews' language in 2 Kings or in Nehemiah. Now, let's talk just a little bit about the Hebrew language. Hebrew is a branch of the great family of ancient Semitic languages which are spoken in Mesopotamia, Syria, Palestine, and Arabia. It is most closely related to the languages spoken by the ancient Canaanites, Phoenicians, and Syrians, and is almost identical with those of the Moabites, Edomites, and Ammonites. The language spoken by the natives of Canaan hardly differed from the biblical Hebrew. One interesting characteristic which Hebrew shares with all Semitic languages is that most of its basic words contain three consonants. It should be noted that the written Hebrew of biblical times consisted of consonants only. Remember, I told you the vowels are not there. And even in a Hebrew, you go to Jerusalem and buy a newspaper off the newsstand, it will not have any vowels in it at all. It's all consonants, and you're supposed to know the language well enough to figure out which consonants to put in. So you do that as you read along, okay? Not until several centuries after Christ, when Hebrew had become a dead language, were vowels added in an endeavor to preserve a knowledge of how the language had been spoken. These vowels consisted of various marks added below, between, and above the consonants, known as vowel pointings, and you saw those. Variations in verb forms are generally produced by a change in vocalization, in other words, the way you speak it. A Hebrew example will show this principle. The verb to write contains three consonants, K, T, B, and that's the way it would be written, K, T, B. Of course, it would be backed around with K, T, B. Well, let me see, for you it would be K, T, B, backwards for us. The following examples show how, through the use of different vowels, various verb forms are produced, while the three basic consonants remain unchanged. If you say katab, he has written katob, write, the imperative, koteb, writing, katub, it is written, katob, to write. And all of those verbs would be written exactly the same in Hebrew. There would be KTB, and you have to figure out which vowels to put in. Personal pronouns are in most cases added to the verb as prefixes or suffixes. Thus, the form I have written, katabti, consists of the basic root katab and ending t, representing the pronoun, and I shall write ektob, of the prefix he and the root ktob. These short grammatical forms are the reason that Hebrew sentences are brief, compact, and forceful. For example, the seventh commandment, thou shalt not commit adultery, Exodus 20, verse 14, consists of five words in English, but only two in Hebrew, lo tenoth. This brevity in Hebrew expressions is especially noticeable in the poetic parts of the Old Testament. In most cases, the Hebrew text has only half as many words as the English translation. The famous 23rd Psalm, for example, has 57 words in the Hebrew Bible, but 122 in the English translation. Job 30, verse 22, which has 6 words in Hebrew, has 18 in the King James Version and 24 in the RSV. So you can see it's a very compact language, which means, if you stop and think about it, it means you have to read it and then you have to interpret it, and interpreting means you put more words. Another characteristic of the Hebrew language is the lack of certain grammatical forms. It knows no compounds except in proper names, and a term like the English landlord, we all know what landlord means, right, can be expressed only by the genitive form in Hebrew, lord of the land. Now, does landlord mean the same as lord of the land? So what do you do if you only have one way to say it, and one time you're talking about the landlord, and the other time you're talking about lord of the land, and it's the same? There's no way to say it differently in Hebrew. The Hebrew language is also poor in adjectives, very few adjectives, and possesses almost no adverbs, a handicap for the ancient writers when expressing abstract thoughts. In common with other Semitic languages, Hebrew possesses a number of sounds that do not exist in an Indo-European language. It has two H sounds, for which Hebrew script has two characters, usually transliterated as H and CH, the latter pronounced as in the Scottish loch. It also has several S sounds, like SZ and SH, in common with English, but two Hebrew sounds transliterated, S with the little thing under and S with the thing over it, have no equivalents in English, the former being pronounced like TZ, the latter is a soft S. The two Hebrew sounds, Aleph and Ayin, also have no equivalents in English. The Hebrew language originally possessed some additional sounds that were presumably dropped before the invention of the alphabetic Hebrew script. One of them was a second Ayin called Gayin, which still exists in Arabic. The early existence of this latter sound in Hebrew can be recognized from the fact that the name Gaza and Gomorrah both begin with the same consonant, ayin, as does the name of the Hebrew high priest Eli. It is only through the ancient translations of the Bible, the Greek Septuagint, later the Latin Vulgate, that we know that the name of the doomed city in which Lot lived was pronounced Gomorrah and not Omorrah, and that the name of the high priest of Samuel's time was Eli and not Geli. So you can just get a little hint of the challenges. The bigger challenge is when you read Hebrew, there are a lot of the words that we have lost their meaning. So you're trying to translate the Old Testament, you're reading along, and you don't know what the word means. What do you do? Brian. Okay. What you do, you take your best guess, but your best guess is usually based on what the Greek translators did, what the Samaritan translators did, yes. Yeah, his four prophets, yeah.
And when he got to the Hebrew, he was almost so overwhelmed he wanted to put it aside.
Yeah.
Because they can say it one way with a little grunt, another way with a little drill on the end, and it's altogether a different word.
Yes, exactly. Okay, well, so I haven't had a chance to talk about the Greek, but we're running out of time, so we'll pick that up next time, and we'll talk more specifically about the story. When we come to the Christian New Testament, the Greek was a completely different thing, whereas very few people were able to read and write Hebrew. By the time we come to the Greek New Testament, many, many, many people could read and write. And so everybody took it upon themselves to make copies, and that led to a whole different set of problems. We'll pick that one up next time. Let's pray. Our kind and loving Father, as we seek to understand this ancient book, or actually, more correctly, ancient collection of books, help us to understand a little bit of the background so that we can read it better and more clearly, and understand the challenges of those who make translations for us.